Late Night Intern Allen Show. It is 10:31 Eastern. Got work tomorrow. Got to be in bed probably right after this pod is over. Monday, July 8th. Missed the pod last week. Was going to record on Tuesday night. Then got really sick. Got COVID. Just finished having COVID. Had COVID for all of July 4th weekend. 2 days off work didn't matter. Had COVID. But we'll get to that. Big week. 2 weeks, I guess, since we last potted. Timberwolves team is slightly different than it was. Some of the changes that I was talking about a month or two ago now kind of happened, which, I mean, depending on how Rob Dillingham pans out primarily, but a couple different people came into the team, a couple different people left the team. One piece re-signed, not even really a piece, but we'll talk about that. We'll also talk about the Twins. We'll actually start with the Twins. 2 weeks of baseball to talk about, All-Star game to talk about, division race to talk about, all that. Then we got a post game. We also have a You Don't Know Ball of the Week. You Don't Know Ball of the 2 weeks in this case, but we have a You Don't Know Ball of the Week to talk about as well. let's get started. The Minnesota Twins have won 4 straight series in a row, each of them since the last pod. Each of them, they won 2 out of 3 of the games. So they perfect 2 out of 3 in every series, 8 out of 12 over the last 4 series. Beat Arizona, Seattle, Detroit, and Houston. None of those teams are great, to be fair, but none of them are horrible. Detroit's not very good, I guess. Arizona, Seattle, and Houston. We're all pretty mediocre right now, somewhere around 500 each of them. All kind of disappointing this year in terms of where their talent level is at. That's kind of most of the league at the moment. As I mentioned before, especially in the AL, but in the NL as well, there's so many teams like in the middle of the pack. The middle of the pack is crazy huge right now. The Twins have actually distanced themselves a little bit, starting to get a little bit of a comfortable lead over the rest of the middle of the pack, but because we're now 51-39, which is well over 500, which until this, you know, recent run of pretty decent play, we were right around 500, maybe like 4 games up most of the time, dipped just about down to exactly 500, then kind of got back up, but significantly above 500 right now. Let me just check the standings real quick. I believe we're still well behind Cleveland, unfortunately.
That's just how hot Cleveland is.
Cleveland is 56-33. We are 51-39. That makes us 5.5 games back in the Central. Let's see if we can get the wild card. We got wild card standings? No. AL wild card standings. Should have looked this up before the pod, but whatever. Yeah, we're currently a good 3 games up on the Royals. Royals are the next. We're right now in the 2nd of 3 wildcard spots. The Royals are in the 4th spot, just outside. Currently, the Yankees, Twins, and Red Sox are the wildcard teams. With the Mariners, who had a good week since we beat them, actually in the lead in the West right now. At 49-43. Anyway, beat Arizona, Seattle, Detroit, and Houston. Each of those series, just kind of team coming together, When we need to hit, we need to hit. Or when we need to hit, we hit. When we need to pitch, we pitch. When we need to do both, we kind of do both. Which is a lot different than it felt at the beginning of the year, which, you know, I've mentioned multiple times. By the way, we're currently playing the White Sox 6-5. And this game is almost more indicative, obviously, you know, ignore the fact that the opponent is really horrible, but this game is very indicative of the way this team has been playing recently. In around the sixth inning, made like three different errors, throwing the ball around the park. We allowed three runs in that inning to fall behind 5-2. And our half of the next inning, or just the next inning, next time up at bat for us, scored five runs. Or scored four runs. We now lead to 6-5. So that type of thing has just been happening for the Twins in a way that it didn't at the beginning of the year. The offense, which obviously started the year poorly, had well-documented struggles through a lot of last year. The offense is as good right now as it has been probably since the 2019 Bomba Squad year. We're not hitting home runs like that, but there's not really a weak link in the lineup. Correa is leading the way with a top 10 OPS in the AL, and that's among qualified players. So there's other people with higher OPSs. Actually, Jose Miranda has a higher OPS than him. Jose Miranda is just on the tear of a fucking lifetime. He's hit safely in 12 straight games right now. It happened, you know, he hit a double a couple innings ago or last inning or whatever. That just happened. And then earlier this week, or the end of last week, hit safely in 12 straight at-bats, which is a major league record, tied for a major league record. I looked up who he's tied with just for kicks, and I was not disappointed. He's tied with Walt Droppo from 1952, Pinky Higgins from 1938, and Johnny Kling from 1902. Johnny Kling's nickname was Noisy, so according to the MLB website. So he's tied with Walt Droppo, Pinky Higgins, and Noisy Kling for most consecutive hits of all time. And Griffin Jack's just allowed is that homer? Oh, no. It's just a lot of bloop single to start the game. Shoot. Of those guys, of Walt Droppo, Pinky Higgins, and Noisy Kling, Pinky Higgins had the best career. Career 290 average. Had a couple years where he batted comfortably over 300, had a couple hundred RBI seasons in the late 1930s. Don't remember what team he played for. Didn't look. Probably could find it. Let me see. I have the tab up still. Pinky Higgins played for, this is the type of shit that I know that I only care about and nobody else cares about, but played for the Philadelphia Athletics. Oh, he was an all-star three times. Twice for the Philadelphia Athletics and once for the Detroit Tigers. Played for the Philadelphia Athletics, the Boston Red Sox, and the Detroit Tigers. Good for him. Pinky Kling. Or Pinky Higgins. Anyway. Where was I? Oh, yeah. Jose Miranda, OPS over 900 right now. His average jumped over the past, like, 2 weeks that he's just been hitting the shit out of the ball. His average just jumped, like, 100 points. It's crazy. He's batting, like, 340 right now. Sorry, I had to text the moon girlfriend back real quick there. Where was I? Pinky Higgins. Miranda's been incredible. Byron Buxton is having a solid year for the first time in a while, feels like. He's been, like, consistently pretty good, which I will take over really, really, like, incredible for 1 week and then shitty for 3 weeks like he used to do. We used to do the whole, oh my God, Brian Ruxton is the best baseball player on the planet for like a week and a half, and then he'd strike out 7 times in a row and not get another hit for 2 weeks. And then we'd have to be like, okay, well, whatever. I'd rather him hit 270 and just, you know, rip a double here or a homer here for like a good chunk of time than hit 400-foot homers for like 5 days in a row and then strike out 3 times the next 18 days. So I like where we're at with him. Body seems fine, not getting injured. Carlos Correa seems to get injured for like 3 hours every day, but other than that, Royce Lewis is injured again, but it should be coming back soon. By the way, I cream my pants for an extended 20 minutes about Royce Lewis last week, and then he went like 0 for 10 and then got hurt. So that's good. Good thing I did that. But yeah, I mean, Willie Castro's contributing, Carlos Santana, Kepler, Larnick, Ryan Jeffers has been good all year. They're all contributing. The Royce thing is tough, obviously. Looked into it a little bit. It's a groin thing, which is completely unrelated to any of the knee stuff he has in his past. Groin stuff can be annoying. It's obviously better than an ACL. There's a quote that was like, it's not as bad as the stuff I've had in the past. Well, no fucking shit. You're not out for 9 months and your season's not over because you tore your knee apart. So like, oh yeah, it's not as bad as the stuff you've had in the past. It still could be bad or still could be pretty annoying to have him out for, you know, I don't know what the real timeline is, but seems like it's closer to the 10 days minimum than it is to like he's going to be out for a month type of thing. If I had to guess. Which, by the way, like, we replaced Royce Lewis with Brooks Lee, who's batting 450, you know, and it's just like he's hitting the shit out of the ball too. His OPS is at 11, so like we're just kind of spoiled with good players right now. Carlos Correa almost took the lead. If you look at this lineup, there's no Shohei Ohtani, there's no Aaron Judge, but there's a lot of really, really solid players. Carlos Correa is leading the way, obviously, as I mentioned, but at any one moment, some guy might have a really good game, and it feels like 1 through 9, everybody's putting in competitive at bats. When you're batting Brooks Lee at like 8, I think he might even be batting 9 this game. Like Ryan Jeffers, who's leading the team in homers, is batting in the bottom of the lineup. Like when that's something that you can do, and you're not putting out a Tsuyoshi Nishioka or a, you know, Darren Mastroianni in the lineup, like we've come a long way, to be honest. And the team has gotten like some pretty healthy depth for this season. Even like when I'm putting out a Kyle Garlick, you know, everybody's a good solid MLB player at the moment. Matt Wallner's back, seems to be hitting the ball way better. Eddie Julian is struggling in AAA, so we'll gloss over that real quick. But I don't know. Like the only real missing link, not even a missing link, the only real weak hitters in the lineup in the club is, you know, Christian Vasquez, who's a backup catcher, and he hits like shit, but last night he hit a walk-off pump, so like, is he really that bad? I mean, he is that bad. He's batting like 200, but, you know, fun little walk-off pump for the guy. Drove in 3 runs that game, so, you know, Manuel Margot could be better, but even he's had like 3 homers in a week, like, in the past month, so, just feels like on the offensive end, everything's kind of humming. We're putting guys on base, scoring a bunch of runs, hitting the ball at a ball yard. It's like 26 straight games with a homer for the club. It's been fun. I mean, it's been fun to watch. It's been fun to watch. Can't say anything else really. Pitching has cooled off a bit. It has. A lot of the games that we've lost, you know, we haven't lost that many games, but of the 4 games that we've lost, couple of them are due to pitching, and there's a couple games that we maybe could have lost if we didn't hit so damn well. But we're sort of bottom, hovering around the bottom third to halfway up the league rankings in ERA. The pitching, especially on the starting side that we kind of expected to pitch well, hasn't. And I guess Pablo Lopez is probably the main part of that. If we go through our like main starters, what are we doing here? Oh, I gotta find starter. Hold up. I had this queued up, and then I looked at something else, and now it's not queued up anymore. Look at the guys that are in the starting lineup right now. Chris Paddock just came back today and did actually pretty good. So he's the highest ERA of anybody with 5.29 ERA in 78 innings. Pablo Lopez is 99 innings at a 5.18 ERA. So at this point, it's just like, this is his year. We're halfway through the year. He's not the guy he was last year. It's not even very close at the moment. Keep kind of saying, oh, like this start was good, and that's, you know, he's creeping his way back to where we know he's going to be. Well, he's not. I mean, he's got a 5.18 ERA. Some of the underlying stuff tells us that he's getting a little bit unlucky in terms of like BABIP and WHIP. His WHIP isn't that bad. You know, compared to a guy like Chris Paddock, whose WHIP is significantly higher for around the same ERA. He's allowing an average of 250, which, you know, isn't horrible, but it's not good. So those guys are probably struggling a little bit. Bailey Ober has been kind of exactly what we expected. He's got a 4.12 ERA, 94 innings pitched right now, halfway through the year. That's on pace to around 200, which is kind of exactly where we want Bailey Ober to be. Joe Ryan has been impressive, and he's a guy that last year really, really struggled with consistency in the second half of the year. And it was, are we going to get good Joe Ryan out there? Or are we going to get like, fuck boy, I don't give a shit about anything, Joe Ryan? And half the time it was, fuck boy, I don't give a shit about anything, I'll allow 5 runs in 4 innings, Joe Ryan. And that's just the type of thing that it's been really good to see that it's not part of this game this year as much. You know, everybody's got a blow up start here and there, but overall, 3.29 and 18 starts, leads the team in innings pitched, leads the team, at least the starters, in WHIP and opponent average. He's been really impressive. Simeon Woods Richardson deserves all the credit in the world as well for, you know, the first year in the majors as a starter. Mentioned on the spot, it's a hard thing to do. It's a hard job to stick around in. How many starters have come up for one or two starts, or maybe even a month, and have been okay for the Twins, then you never hear them again. It's hard to stick, and Simeon Woods Richardson is sticking right now. Just had another 6 innings and 3 runs allowed last week, last night, sorry. It seems like that's what he does every game. Is a good 5 or 6 innings with the, you know, 2 or 3 runs allowed. His ERA is currently 3.48. In 77 innings now, so it's not a fluke at this point. He's made 15 starts. David Festa made his debut and was not particularly good. Was actually rather bad. David Festa is our top pitching prospect right now, I believe. He's mostly our top pitching prospect because the other pitching prospects are now not prospects anymore. That being Simeon Woods Richardson and Louis Varland. Also Matt Canarino, whatever happened to him. But I'm not as locked in on the prospects right now, but I'm not going to look them up now. It's not a good use of my time on the pod. As far as the bullpen, Griffin Jackson not being an all-star is crazy. It's mostly because people don't know who he is. I think even if Joan Duran had the numbers that Griffin Jacks had, even though he's a Twin and people still aren't locked in on the Twins bullpen, like Joan Duran has enough pop in sort of name recognition game right now across all of Major League Baseball that he would probably get in with the year that Griffin Jacks has had. His numbers are crazy. He just allowed a run, unfortunately. But he leads he doesn't quite lead the team, the relievers, in any pitch. That's actually Cole Sands, which is shocking. I mean, he's a long reliever guy, but leads in appearances for sure. He's got all the high leverage stuff. 1.88 ERA coming into this game. Just a lot of runs, so that's going to go up slightly. But ERA around 2 in 40 appearances for, you know, a whip under 1, average under 200 playing against. He should be an all-star, but... let's transition, I guess, into a bigger point about the all-star game in baseball. As far as the actual game is concerned, the game, watching the game, the actual event, it is the best all-star game in sports. Everybody's given 100% effort, because 100% effort is in a sport that you can do for 162 games a year, so it's not like football where you have to try hard on an incredibly dangerous sport that beats the shit out of your body. It's not like basketball where even trying hard is just a bit of a grind that NBA players don't like to do. You're sitting around, you're pitching, and you're hitting, and you're going and catching fly balls, making defensive plays. And so because of that, you don't have to, like, come out and try really hard. So that makes, like, what actually happens an actual, like, palatable and watchable product. Even if you're, like a pitchers have to, you know, they got to ramp up for their couple innings in the All-Star game. You got to throw, like, meaningful competitive pitches. And I'm not saying that that's not hard work, but it's work they'd be doing anyway in a bullpen to keep loose over the break anyway. So, you know, might as well pitch 2 innings in the All-Star game. Anyway, I digress. The point is, the actual All-Star game itself is the best game in sports. But the way that, like, the All-Star teams themselves are comprised is not super connected to who's actually a good player in the league and who's actually not as great of a player. The snubs versus who got in list, it gets worse and worse every year. I'm not going to go over it in depth this year, but Ryan Jeffers feels like a snub for us. Griffin Jacks already mentioned, feels like a snub for us. You could make the case for a Joe Ryan. Correa is our only All-Star game appointee. He's the only one that actually made the All-Star team. Which, on one hand, is okay. You know, as a team, we are a very balanced team. That's something I mentioned. And so it kind of makes sense for us to not have it. To be a pretty damn good... We're a pretty damn good baseball team, right? We're on pace for 92 wins. But so it makes sense that, you know, despite that us being a really good team, we're a very balanced team. No one guy is leading the way in a crazy manner. And our depth, really, 1 through 9 is what's making the team good right now. Like, that is true, but still there's a lot of players on this team that are better than some players that are not. There's a lot of players on the Minnesota Twins that are better than some players on the All-Star team, but we just don't play in that kind of market. Jose Miranda is another one that I didn't mention. Obviously, the week that he's had, the month that he's had, deserves to be at least sort of in the conversation. We were talking about the bullpen. Cole Sands, as I mentioned, is leading the team in innings pitched. Has actually settled in very impressively. I was a little bit dubious at the beginning of the year. He's getting roughed around a little bit. ERA's mid-3s right now. It's perfectly fine. He's more of a long reliever, middle reliever, low leverage guy, but those are important guys to have. I mean, every reliever spot is important in today's baseball, and he's been a pretty decent reliever. Steven Okert is the most boring and average reliever of all time. He'll be good one game and then he'll give up 2 runs the next game. It's not the worst thing you can say to somebody that he's so boring and average and nothing, but that's kind of what he is. his story is actually crazy, but like got a really bad surgery that's like worse than Tommy John, but needed it obviously, and now throws 101, so that's crazy. But in terms of production, he's like so middle of the road, nobody reliever that you've ever heard of, that, you know, that's what he is, which is better than Alex Colomé, you know, being known for as shitty you are. But who else? Jorge Alcala has actually like figured it out. I've been waiting on the Jorge Alcala was Joan Duran before Joan Duran was. Like, he was relevant in the Twin system and on the Twins before Joan Duran. Joan Duran passed him, like lapped him completely and left him in the dust. And then now Jorge Alcala is like better than Joan Duran out of nowhere. After like 3 years of being so like bad, not bad, like he was pretty bad in the majors past 3 years, but like decent at AAA. All of a sudden the stuff kind of makes sense. He always had the super live fastball. But now the control is there. The secondary pitch is there. I think he's got an ERA in the ones right now on quite a few appearances. Let me look back. Twenty-one games, 31 innings. ERA is 1.72. Whip right around one. Yeah, he's been really good. Josh Staumont has never allowed a run until today in 19 appearances. He was hurt at one point. And the rest, I'm okay never seeing out there ever. So that's the Cody Funderburks of the world. I don't think Caleb Thielbars of the world. I don't need to see, I'm kind of done with Jay Jackson. If he ever finds his way back on the major league roster, I'm done with. We don't need that to happen. Anybody else that is really in there is there because of an injury or an emergency in terms of usage. But I'm okay never seeing them. But that's all to say that the bullpen has been. It's taken a step back. It's taken a step back. Some of those guys, especially, I think that we haven't talked about Joan Duran even. Joan Duran having an ERA in the mid threes is, you know, not. It's hard to criticize. Mid threes is fine, but compared to where he used to be in terms of like the low twos, it used to be Jackson and Duran were competing for who's got the best ERA, and Duran got all the shine. Well, Jackson was kind of a new guy. It's sort of switched, where Duran is a bit. Less than he used to be. And unfortunately, there's a reason that bullpen arms are not valued very highly. There's a reason that there's a random dude in every, like, there's six random dudes in every bullpen across the country that nobody's ever heard of before. And that's because guys that don't have the stamina trait with their pitching, they can't throw 95 for seven straight innings, get turned into guys that throw 101 for one inning at a time, and then that is very, very tough on the arm over the years, and gradually the stuff sort of starts to dull in a little bit. And so his whip's still right around one, so like we're not gonna freak out, but some of the contact has been pretty hard on that one hit per inning type of thing. And the fastball is running like 100 instead of 102, which, like, again, we're really nitpicking. We're spoiled right now, but if he can lock in a little bit, get that sort of A++ stuff right on back, that'd be good. He's pitching right now. So as I speak, he just bounced a curveball. Attaboy. That'd be huge for the Twins come playoff time, which we will be in, knock on wood. I don't want to jinx anything that something's crazy happening, but the way this team is playing, we will be in the playoffs. Again, we are a 92 win team right now based on the sort of pace, and we're 0-14 against the, what were they, the Orioles, the Yankees, and the Guardians. If we win half those games, we're a 100 win team. We win half those teams, we go from a 92 to 99. We're on pace to be like a 102 win team if we win half those games. So we're a really good fucking team. Anyway, Was that all the Twins stuff? Let me just check. That's all the Twins stuff. We move on. The Minnesota Timberwolves. I had spoken 2 weeks ago, just a couple days before the draft, about how nothing this draft was going to be for everybody. You know, it's the worst draft in 25 years. Not that I was around for those, but that's what I've been told. There's a TikTok going around this past week where the number one pick in the NBA draft has said that he's never scored 40 points in a game. LaMelo Ball scored 92 once when he was, 15 years old? I mean, I know that's not how they teach it in Europe, where every single fucking player from this past draft was from, but just not a lot of super high-end talent when they're talking about the number one overall pick being hopefully a good fourth option on a championship team someday. You know, you're not exactly, you know, changing the course of franchises on that night. I mean, one of the people drafted last week will be a perennial all-star that is really, really good for a team. We just don't. One of them will be the Nikola Jokic that comes out of nowhere and is all of a sudden really good. That will happen. Almost nobody could know or even guess who it is. Anyway, to the Timberwolves. We're in the draft. We got the 27th pick in the draft, right? In a draft that is completely nothing. I don't even give a shit who that player is. He's not going to be relevant. All of a sudden, we trade up to the 8th pick. We get Rob Dillingham, who, in my opinion, in terms of like, and maybe this is just because I was able to watch him play college basketball last year. Maybe that's a little bit of a bias on my part. But in my opinion, that guy seems more ready to score at the NBA level than almost anybody else in the draft. We don't know if Zachary Risache can score at the NBA level. We don't know that at all. We don't know whether Alex Sarr can score at the NBA level. We know a guy like Reed Shepard is going to make shots for an NBA team. We know that, sure. But, you know, hoping a guy is Duncan Robinson and picking him with the 3rd pick is crazy. Anyway, in terms of creating your own shot, though, I'm not sure that there's a guy in this draft that is better at that than Rob Dillingham. He is one of the best shooters in the draft and one of the few people in the draft, to my eyes, that can get anywhere on the court he wants with his handle. And we have seen how important that is. We have seen how important that is. Teams that have a lot of guys that can do that are so much more successful, especially in the playoffs when everything gets harder, when the defense gets harder everywhere. We have seen how important that guy is to scoring the basketball. Now, what did I say about this Timberwolves team a month and a half ago or whatever it was? I said, we need more guys that can score. He's not Chris Middleton. We're never going to get Chris Middleton. We had no money to spend. But in terms of meaningfully changing this team, we still had no money to spend. We had like a player that we're hoping, to the caliber that we're hoping to get Rob Dillingham at, like that we're, if Rob Dillingham performs, having gone after him in the draft and traded up using our draft capital instead of paying for it, there's no way we could afford a player like Rob Dillingham if he plays the way we hope him to play. There's no way we could afford a player like him in free agency. And that's a guy that's going to be instant offense off the bench. He's going to hopefully be really involved in that second unit. He does not play defense at an NBA level. He probably never will play defense at an NBA level, but we don't need him to ever do that. He never needs to be a starter for us. He just needs to be an offense guy off the bench to help that second unit, to take, you know, shot creation duties away from Nikhil Alexander-Walker, who was never good at doing that. Monte Morris is gone. He didn't really ever find a role with us because he just kind of couldn't cut it. So to have an elite offensive level player, or to have an elite level offensive player in the college game, come onto our second unit, try to lead the way a little bit there, spell some of the Mike Conley minutes, obviously. That seems to be an ideal fit. The weakness is our defense. The weakness is our consistency. He didn't start at Kentucky because he wasn't consistent enough. He didn't sort of keep the pulse of the game and control the game the way he should have. We don't need him to do that. We don't need him to. He needs to score the bucket when Anthony Edwards is and Mike Conley off the court. We need consistency from those two guys. But anyway, so I like that move. All that to say, I like that move. I think it is almost the best case scenario for what could happen in that draft. The draft should have been meaningless. It wasn't because of that move. We are going to the top of the 11th. Let's go Twins. At pick 27, we picked Terrence Shannon Jr., who by all accounts did not do any of the horrible things that he was accused of during the year. Did not abuse any women. Terrence Shannon Jr. is in elite level, top end volume scorer. He's not a Rob Dillingham type where it's just instant little jolts of offense. He's a guy that for Illinois carried the ball up the court 90 million times a game. Just, we're going to run the Terrence Shannon play. I'm going to go get a bucket. So efficiency numbers aren't going to be high. Shooting percentages aren't necessarily going to be high. But averaged 23 points in a game in college in the Big Ten, which is a difficult thing to do. Was top scorer in the country. One of the top scorers in the country. Maybe not quite. I don't know. I remember hearing something like that. He gets his bucket through a lot of driving the ball and a lot of shooting from the outside. Now, even extending the range a little bit beyond the three-point line, which just in the NBA is just the three-point line, I guess. But he's only 6'6". He's not the type of athlete that's going to have a lot of success in the NBA driving the ball, I don't think. A guy like Dillingham, Anthony Edwards, Conley, they're small. They're small, much smaller than 6'6", but they get everywhere on the court through the handle, through their wiggle. A guy like Kyrie, think. This is not that player. Terrence Shannon doesn't seem to have that kind of handle that way. A lot of his drives were very like physicality-based. At 6'6", he's bigger than a lot of college guards, but he will not be bigger than a lot of NBA. He will not be a big enough guard to mow his way into the paint, and he won't be playing point guard. He'll be playing wing. He won't have that skill at the NBA level to rely on. Also, he doesn't shoot the ball at a high enough percentage to be sort of relied on as a consistent NBA three-point shooter. All of that being said, he scored 23 points a game in college, and there's some guys in basketball that just know how to score and whipping out all the in-depth metrics or the body type bullshit may not apply to guys that just, oh, he just knows how to get a bucket. Like, he's just a guy that just knows how to get a bucket. DeMar DeRozan has made a bajillion dollars out of just knowing how to get a bucket. He's not that guy, obviously, but, like, in a draft where most teams recognized that there wasn't a top-end star, and so they invested heavily in European guys or guys that were, you know, lottery ticket investments. Maybe he turns into Jokic, maybe he turns into Giannis, maybe he doesn't. Terrence Shannon is a guy that we know kind of exactly what he is, and that elite offensive level ability can maybe help this team right away. And so that is, I think, sort of along with the fact that he may have fallen because of some of the character issues that seem to not exist, may actually represent quite a bit of value for us getting him as late as we did in the 27th pick of the draft. By the way, trading up to the 8th without giving up a pick this year, we gave up some 13-year-olds from 2030 draft. You know, Big Justice from that TikTok just got drafted. You know, we gave up him. I don't know if that's actually his age. But yeah, I think it is. the end of that sentence is giving up not picks this year was impressive. Jesus, it's late. Okay. We got to think here. We also drafted a guy named Bobby Clintman. I'll be shocked if he ever plays for the Minnesota Timberwolves for real, but he sounds like a G League player if I've ever heard one. I looked up his scouting report. We got good size and shooting ability possible. Could grow into a potential future role player. He could grow into the potential of being a role player. So, I guess like a tall wing that can shoot the ball a little bit. It's going to be like Alexei Pukashevsky or something. I mean, sure, fine, whatever. That's the type of pick that I expected us to make for both of these picks where it just moves the needle, not at all. I do think both the other guys we got have potential to move the needle. Rob Dillingham will, for sure, on some level. But, yeah, I think it was a good draft. Free agency came around. Couple moves of note here. Twins just scored a run. We are now leading the game in the top of the 11th. Let's go. Was that Brooks Lee that just drove then? It sure was. That guy rocks. We got to get him a new number. He's wearing 72. He's hitting way better than a 72 should be. Hell yeah. All right. Oh, free agency. We got Joe Ingles. Joe Ingles is the most Minnesota player of all time. I mean, to see the frat dude that, like, is kind of into sports, but, like, not really. Enough to know that Joe Ingles is on the Timberwolves. I can see him buying a Joe Ingles Timberwolves jersey just because he's a white guy. Hopefully my characterization of that guy makes sense and never was actually in a frat or at a school that had frats. So, other than, I guess, Miami had frats, but it's a little different. A little different. Those guys are so unbelievably douchey that, like, I don't think they exist in Minnesota. anyway, Joe Ingles, perfect Minnesota player. White guy, shoots threes. Really old at this point, but playing for the minimum, so it costs us nothing. Replaces Kyle Anderson, who left. I don't think they're the same player as much as it seems like they are. Kyle Anderson has turned being slow into, like, his main advantage on the court. All the jokes about how it takes, like, a whole two business days for him to get a shot up from the three-point line, they're funny. But, like, Kyle Anderson is so comfortable being slow that it's, like, part of his game. I don't think Joe Ingles is like that. I think he's a more traditional run and get open, center of the corner, knock down shots. It will be nice to see a regular fucking three-point motion from your guy that's supposed to knock down three-point shots. It'll be better. I think he's a better shooter in general. Maybe less of a playmaker. But he's been around for so long that he, like, knows what he's doing. And it's good to have a vet like that regardless. I'm glad we could replace one. I don't know if it moves the needle entirely. Him as better than Kyle Anderson, that's a crazy blog post that somebody out there probably wrote is player breakdown. Who's better, Kyle Anderson or Joe Ingles? And some nerd loved reading that. I would self-identify as I would love to write that, and I would love to read it. Anyway, Monte Morris also gone. I mentioned that earlier. Jordan McLaughlin is gone. He hadn't played in the past few years. Just kind of wasn't good enough in the team anymore. He can go be relevant and play actual rotation minutes on a team like the Hornets or something. Where'd he actually go? He actually went somewhere and I forgot it. PJ Dozier signed. I don't know anything about PJ Dozier. I didn't give a shit to look him up. He won't play meaningful minutes. Luka Garza re-signed. That was the big piece that re-signed that I mentioned earlier. I like having Luka Garza on our team for some reason. I don't know why. I think it's that he was really good at Iowa. He was National Player of the Year, all that shit. Scored like 20 points a game. Was a walking like 23 and 12 for that Iowa team. I think I like having that guy on our team, even though he's completely irrelevant, because when he comes in the game, I'm like, oh, there he is. Big-time college player. Let's see what he does. And then he usually is, like, fine. But so glad to have him back, I guess. That was Sarah Luca Garza talk. With free agency, it's always nice to look at your team and be like, okay, did we get better? Did we not? And it's nice to, like, buy into pieces and be like, okay, we got better. We didn't have a lot to work with, but I do think we got better. That being said, I guess over the entire offseason so far, I do think we've gotten better. That being said, other teams have gotten better by more, which is always what you kind of have to compare it to. The Thunder got Caruso, Alex Caruso, and Isaiah Hartenstein, which their main struggles last year, the Thunder, were Josh Giddey, just in general, all-encompassing on-court, off-court. Josh Giddey was a problem for them last year. And then not having a big man to play with Chet, or to play when Chet wasn't in, just not having another big man other than Chet. And when you're big, when your one big man is skinnier than Intern Allen, then you have a difficulty with some of the more physical teams in the NBA. Isaiah Hartenstein is considerably bigger and stronger than Intern Allen, and was a really, really good player, especially the defensive end for the Knicks last year. And so I'm a little scared as to how well he'll fit in, how good of a fit he is with the Knicks. I'm scared as in I think he's going to be a good fit, or not the Knicks, with the Thunder. I'm scared as in I think he's going to be a good fit with the Thunder, and I think both him and Caruso are going to move the needle in kind of a big way for them. On your hand, also in the West, the Clippers blew up, so don't have to worry about them anymore. We didn't really have to worry about them at all. They weren't very good. The Mavs, we'll see. I'm not sure. Klay Thompson's on the Mavs now, if you weren't aware. I'm not sure that that's going to move the needle in a significant way. I think he is very cooked. I think he's very washed. I haven't liked Klay ever, really. I think he's a loser in post-game press conferences. I just kind of hate all the Warriors. I'm a Warriors hater. But that team definitely needed shooting. He definitely provides shooting. I just don't know, even as simply a spot-up shooter, if he's, like, a good enough athlete to play in the NBA anymore, especially the defensive end. He's not a good defender anymore. And that team had a lot of, like, really fun athletic defenders that he'll be taking the place of, and I just don't know if it's... I just think he's a little bit washed. Quite a bit washed. So we'll see. Denver got worse. Kentavious Caldwell-Pope is gone, and this is another season after losing Bruce Brown. So two of, like, the huge pieces, huge role player pieces on that championship team are now gone. And they, you know, were sad to not have Bruce Brown last year. There's a lot of times, even in our series, where a guy like Bruce Brown, who's just a little bit of an offensive spark, was needed when they went 30 minutes without scoring against us. Not actually 30 minutes, but, you know, close. And they're going to lose defense and shooting with KCP leaving. And just size as at the wing position. It's not like guys like that don't grow on trees as much as the NBA seems like they do. And I mean, yeah. So we'll see. I mean, Denver looks worse. I think Thunder might low-key run the West. We'll talk about the Lakers in a minute with my You Don't Know Ball Take of the Week, but they're not going to be relevant. The Kings added DeMar DeRozan. I don't see that. I mean, they'll be good, but I don't feel like they're a team that makes sense in the playoffs. It's like construction-wise. Like, maybe they do. Can't help but feel that what a lot of DeMar DeRozan does really well overlaps with some of the stuff that DeMontis Sabonis does really well, in a way that they can't really, like, you're going to each of them is going to be giving up some of themselves to make that fit work, which then obviously you're not getting as high upside.
It'd be interesting to see. Any other free agency things off the top of my head? Paul George to the Sixers. We don't talk about the East a whole ton because unless we face them in the finals, it's not super relevant. But I think I've been a big fan of Paul George for a while. I think that he is a guy that has a skill set that fits into any style of play anywhere in the league, anywhere in the world even. He can shoot better than most, he can defend better than most, he can dribble the ball better than most, he can pass better than most. And he's not elite at one thing, but he's an elite basketball player because he can fit everywhere. I need some water real quick. Cody Funderburk's in the game. Jesus Christ, why? Probably because we're out of pitchers. It's the bottom of the 11th. He's not very good. What was I saying? Paul George, the Sixers. It's the right move for them. They need an elite guy to kind of fit in everywhere else. It was a little bit clear that they didn't, with just Joel Embiid and Tyrese Maxey, they didn't have enough star power, but you can't add another, you know, you can't add another ball-centric or ball-dominant scorer. You couldn't add a Devin Booker to them, not that he was available, but, like, you couldn't add a guy that's going to dribble the ball a bunch and take a bunch of shots and look for his own a bunch. Paul George will do that when he has to, but he's such a good team basketball player that I think he's one of the stars that can move around everywhere and fit in everywhere. So I like the move for them. They just have to stay healthy, and that's a Paul George thing and an Embiid thing as well. Why do I feel like my tooth is falling out? Like what? That's crazy. Hope my tooth doesn't fall out. That'd be, like, embarrassing. It's too late. I think that's it. You don't know ball take the week is if you think that the Lakers did, like, some horrible strategic misstep by drafting LeBron James Jr., you don't know ball. That is the you don't know ball take the week, and here's why. Second round picks, especially late second round picks, are worth exactly nothing. Maybe one of them, every now and then, will turn into a good player, but for the most part, they are worth completely and exactly nothing. I'm scrolling through Basketball Reference right now, and again, I haven't looked at this in advance, so this isn't some planned preparation that I'm doing here. I don't know what I'm gonna see, but I'm so confident that these players aren't gonna be good that I'm gonna do it anyway. Last year's 55th overall pick, Isaiah Wong, to Indiana. In 1 year, he played one game, and he played 4 minutes and scored 2 points. His rookie year was massive. He played one game. Twins win, let's go. Cody Funderburk did it. I always believed. Isaiah Wong, by the way, Miami Kane legend, took us to the Final Four. The next year before that, the 55th overall pick was a guy named Gui Santos. G-U-I Santos. In his 2 year career, he's played 23 games. A total of 192 minutes. He's averaging 3.6 points per game. That is one of the most successful late second round picks I've ever seen. but completely irrelevant. Still, 2021 draft. The 55th overall pick is Aaron Wiggins. This guy's actually a decent player in the real NBA. He's actually okay. So that's strike one against my point here, but he's not changing the course of their franchise, let's be honest. He's a bench player for OKC. They'd probably still win almost all of the games that they did win without him. Year before that, the 55th pick overall went to Brooklyn. His name is Jay Scrubb. Yes, he is also a scrub. He played 24 games in the NBA and is no longer in the league. 2019 NBA draft. The 55th overall pick is named Kyle Guy, Virginia legend, won a title. 53 games in the NBA in 3 years, no longer in the league. Or might be in the league, barely kicking around. Year before that, to Charlotte, a guy named Arnoldis Kulboka, who played 2 games in the NBA before he wasn't in the league anymore. The point is that at 55th overall pick, you are not going to be getting anything anyway. The pick is already worth nothing. And add to that, this is one of the worst drafts in the history of the NBA. So you're picking guys that are worth nothing to a draft that is already worth nothing. Add to that, that it will make the best player of all time happy to draft his son. All of that, simply making LeBron happy is more important than the asset of the 55th pick. And here's why. Or you're like, oh, well, making LeBron happy, he's going to play either way, blah, blah, blah. No. The Los Angeles Lakers have a history in their franchise of appealing to stars, to star players. Part of their whole thing is that when you're a star, you come to LA. When Dwight Howard was at the peak of his powers, what did he do? He went to LA. When Steve Nash, at the end of his career, went to LA. Karl Malone was a star, went to LA at the end of his career to try to win a ring. Kobe Bryant was in LA the whole time, but they gave him a massive contract at the end of his career that he was not deserving of as a player on the court anymore. But his past just showed that he deserved that money. They paid him for what he'd done, a legacy contract almost. That was a negative impact on the team. The team wasn't very good because of that contract, but treating star players really well is what the Los Angeles Lakers do, and that is why they continue to get star players. So when you get the best star player of the game has ever seen, even though he's 40, still a really damn good player, still a top 10 player in the league, even though he's 40, you have to do what he wants you to do, because that is what you have always done, and that is why you will continue to get stars after he leaves. And stars like LeBron James win titles. He already won a title. Maybe the next star will win you a title too. So you have to continue to treat stars well. So that is why you have to pander to LeBron James and draft his son. That is, you have to do it. You have to do it. Especially considering that I've already mentioned the 55th pick is worth nothing. Add on to the fact that the publicity and the jersey sales and the media coverage and all of that that Bronny James is getting right now is exactly the type of thing that the Lakers feed on. It is what makes the Lakers the Lakers. This is what makes basketball in Hollywood. They paid him a fairly sizable contract for a late second round pick. They did. Fully guaranteed, couple million, whatever, 4 years. And you could make the argument that, like, okay, maybe that's only because he's LeBron James' son. You can make that argument, sure. He's
already, without ever playing a minute for them, beyond some summer league minutes, scored 4 points, no big deal. Before ever playing a minute for them, he has already made up that money and more in like the media revenue and the jersey sales and all the sort of stuff around who Bronny James is and who this story and what this story is, LeBron James, LeBron James. He's already justified that money and more in 3 days. I don't have the books in front of me, but I promise you that. And all of that aside, so if Bronny James never plays a minute for the Lakers, it was worth it. It is so worth it for them to make that investment if he never plays a game for them. All of that aside, there's a chance that Bronny James is actually a decent NBA player. There's a chance he is Aaron Wiggins. There's a chance he's one of the most successful 55th picks in the draft before. Of the guys that came before him. Before his heart condition last year, multiple people were calling him, a first-round pick. This guy's a top 20 pick. This guy's a 15th pick type of thing. He's an athletic guard that can shoot the ball. He's a little undersized, but knows the game well. The upside maybe isn't there in the way that you'd like to see at the top end of the first round, but should be a pretty good role player, do his role, come off the bench for a number of years in the NBA. People were saying that he's, I saw one tweet that said, okay, he should be a top 15 pick, from back then. Obviously, he has the heart condition. That sort of blows up in everybody's face. But now, and he doesn't have a good year at USC. After, recovering from said heart condition, there's still a chance that he is that player. He's getting comparisons to Davion Mitchell, who's a really good defender for his size, can shoot the ball a little bit, can hang around an NBA roster for, a good 8 years. If he's that player, then even without him being LeBron James Jr., he's a steal at the 55th pick. And then you add in all the other stuff, and it just makes no sense to criticize the Lakers in any kind of way for making this pick. Of course, he's only being drafted because he's LeBron James' dad. That's kind of the whole point. And so if you ask, if you're asking the Lakers to have some sort of moral, high standing that they're not going to draft somebody just because he's LeBron James' son, then you're asking them to give up millions and millions and millions of dollars in sort of revenue for all the other stuff and sort of their identity of making stars happy, which they've always done. Anyway, I think you guys get the point. If you think Bronny James to the Lakers was a bad idea for the Lakers, you don't know ball, period. Let's go to the post game. Post games, I have COVID. I was going to go into a whole story about how I got COVID and just what happened, but I was really sick and now I'm not really sick anymore. Kind of ruined my 4th of July plans. 4th of July was literally laying in bed the whole time because I had a fever and couldn't stay awake or eat food. It hit me pretty good, I guess. Took some medicine, now I'm back, I feel completely fine. I need to go to bed though. That's the post game. I had COVID, now I don't. Sick emoji, like the green one with the thermometer.